thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Well, at least
here's John Williams.
Someone is. I'll do my best. It's John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Weekdays 1 to 3, Saturdays 10 to noon. Social media. WGN King John. That's where you'll find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't miss the Mincing Rascals. Boy, are they going to have something to talk about. Our award-winning podcast will drop tomorrow. And that'll be just a fine hoo-ha. Somebody asked me a question. Any question. Any question at all. Lauren Lapka, just ask me any question you want in the whole wide world.
What's your favorite color?
And my answer is, I'm pointing to my producer over there. Yoo-hoo!
I'm not going to speak to that.
That's my answer. Ask me another question.
What is your favorite Latin word?
Here's my answer to that.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
That's all I got. This thing's been very disappointing to me.
It's very discouraging.
It really is. And I don't know if this is going to ever color Robert Mueller's career and life in America's mind, but he's this decorated war hero. He's a public servant. He left a profitable life to serve the American people and has admirably, and he's not performing admirably today.
So, and on either side, I mean, if the Republicans are going to accuse him of being unfair or something, I want him to answer that. You know, if he's got a good answer for it, I want to hear what it is.
His testimony is wobbly, and it's surprisingly uninformed. I know he didn't want to testify, and he's not supposed to testify outside the findings of the report itself, but he seems to not even be able to do it if he had to, right? He was asked, among other things, who appointed him U.S. attorney, and he got it wrong. He had the wrong president. He actually didn't remember that. One of the Republicans asked him a question and didn't let him answer, but they inferred that he didn't write even the summary. And I don't know what now Robert Mueller knows about the Mueller investigation. All he does is say, I'm not going to answer that. I'm not going to answer that. And if it's going to compromise some future investigations, Steve, then I guess so. But at some point you want to say, man, stand up for yourself.
No, yeah, it's not about future investigations for by and large. He said that during his 9-minute news conference, you know, this will be my testimony. And so that's what he's doing. But, you know, so if you and I are going to be questioned by investigators and we submit a statement and we sit before the investigators, we could not say, well, look at my statement, could we? You'd have to answer the question. I mean,
well, a lot of times people don't answer, it seems to me, questions put before
them. At least they pretend to try or pretend to, you know, obfuscate or something. But I just feel like, I respect that he doesn't want to go beyond, but I think we're entitled, or not entitled, we deserve some more answers on to these questions. Even if he doesn't go beyond what he's written, I want to hear him explain it a little bit more.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I mean, not only is he in his own, maybe he is taking the high road, but it looks obstinate. But his bumbling way, his inability to recall the details, or unwillingness to accept that the Congress people have it right until he looks it up, he just seems totally flummoxed.
Yeah, see, I don't see it that way. I don't view him as flummoxed. I view him as just saying, I'm not going to get caught here. I'm not going to answer your questions.
Really? I think that's generous.
Okay.
Who knows? I mean, really, if I keep waiting for this you can't handle the truth moment, maybe it will come.
He made it clear that day he's not going
to
do that.
There's no disservice to himself, one of the two. I mean, what would be the harm if he just stood up for his report? You know, the only time he really pushed back, there's only been twice, and it's when he was defending the staff. He said, I've never made a political hire for political purposes, a hire for political reasons. I never even ask what the, you know, leanings are of the people that I hire. You might argue that he probably knows, but that's his testimony. And then when they started to question the report, he said, these are people who have worked expeditiously. And I think he's probably right about that. Those people that gave 2 years of their lives, that was a real service to this country.
That area has jumped out at me, too. It looks like they're taking a bit of a break in the hearing now. But I think we are entitled to know whether he thinks Bill Barr mischaracterized his report. Now, only he can answer that question. That's not getting away in any investigation or anything like that. I think we're deserve to know the answer. Maybe the answer is that he didn't, that's exactly what he thought. But I think he should answer that question.
I'm not going to speak to that.
It's my new ringtone. Phone rings, I don't want to answer it. I'm not going to speak to that. How convenient. Both sides so far can claim victory then, right? Democrats were at least able to read his words, damning as they are, to a country that didn't read the report. I mean, that's all they do now. I mean, that's really all it's come to.
Right. He can't
recall it. He won't. So they just read it.
Mueller can't get a word in edgewise when the Republicans are questioning because the Republicans want to make their mark. Democrats are begging him to talk, and he won't. So all we hear are the Democratic. It doesn't mean anything to hear a Democratic congressman read from the Mueller report.
Oh, really? You don't think there's any value in them scoring any points?
It's got to come from Mueller. It doesn't matter.
You want him to read it?
Well, I'm saying for the Democrats to score points, it doesn't help that Gerald Nadler's reading the report. It's got to be Mueller's voice using it.
Republicans are able to criticize the findings in minute detail in the report and the people who wrote it. At the close of the first session today, as they were wrapping things up, the president sent a direct text message to millions of his followers. They include me. The text read, "There was no collusion, ! Let's tell the Dems to end this witch hunt by raising $2 million in 24 hours. Contribute now." So the president is making some hay, probably off of this. I want to play for you just a clip. It's ongoing. They've paused, actually, just now. But if you haven't been able to watch or hear it, and when it started, Brenda and I put it on, and then both of us put that sort of sour look on our face, the sort of thing like when you get a bill and you don't want to pay it and it's bigger than you thought. We had that look on our face. Even Daisy was upset. And I think Daisy's a Republican. But they were on TV in my house, and it was just very unsettling. And I thought, well, John, what did you think? What did you think this morning was going to be like? Both sides are going to pontificate. They're going to ask questions that we all sort of know the answers to. And if you want Robert Mueller to step out of the box, he won't. I thought he would. Maybe he yet will. I'm still waiting for that Jack Nicholson moment where he says, "You can't handle the truth. Congressman, you can't handle the truth. You want me on that conference room. You need me on that conference room." Hasn't happened yet. But if anything was representative of what's happened so far today, it is this series of questions from a Republican lawmaker and Robert Mueller. They're talking about the Steele dossier and then what that implies. And while it seems to be kind of pointless to go down that road, because, of course, he's not going to talk about that, this is an illustration of two things, that the Republicans have an agenda, the same way the Democrats do, mind you. I'm mostly playing this just to illustrate my frustration with Robert Mueller, but I could have done the Democratic version of this as well. But so here's the Republican agenda, and here is Robert Mueller's agenda. This is a man who should not have come to work today.
Given your 22 months of investigation, tens of million dollars spent, and millions of documents reviewed, did you obtain any evidence at all that any American voter changed their vote as a result of Russia's election interference?
I'm not going to speak to that.
You can't speak to that? After 22 months of investigation, there's not any evidence in that document before us that any voter changed their vote because of their interference, and I'm asking you, based on all the documents that you reviewed.
That was outside our purview.
Russian meddling was outside your purview?
But the impact of that meddling was undertaken by other agencies.
Okay. You stated in your opening statement that you would not get into the details of the Steele dossier. However, multiple times in Volume 2 on page 23, 27, and 28, you mentioned the unverified allegations. How long did it take you to reach the conclusion that it was unverified?
I'm not going to speak to that.
It's actually in your report multiple times that it's unverified, and you're telling me that you're not willing to tell us how you came to the conclusion that it was unverified.
True.
When did you become aware that the unverified Steele dossier was included in the FISA application to spy on Carter Page?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
When did you become aware that the unverified Steele dossier was included in the FISA application to spy on Carter Page?
I'm not going to speak to that.
Your team interviewed Christopher Steele, is that correct?
Not going to get into that.
You can't, you can't tell this committee as to whether or not you interviewed Christopher Steele in a 22-month investigation with 18 lawyers.
As I said at the outset, that is one of those investigations that is is being handled by others in the Department of Justice.
Yeah, but you're here testifying about this investigation today. And I am asking you directly, did any members of your team or did you interview Christopher Steele in the course of your investigation?
And I am not going to answer that question, sir.
You had 2 years to investigate. Not once did you consider it worthy to investigate how an unverified document that was paid for by a political opponent was used to obtain a warrant to spy on the opposition political campaign. Did you do any investigation in that whatsoever?
I do not accept your characterization of what occurred.
What would be your characterization?
I'm not going to speak any more to it.
So you can't speak any more to it, but you're not going to agree with my characterization. Is that correct?
Yes.
So that's a great example. When that congressman was referring to the government investigators as spying on Carter Page,
yeah,
he should have, I think he owed it to the American people to clarify that,
yeah,
and to say it wasn't spying on Carter Page. It was a legal surveillance approved by the courts. Those are the sorts of things that I wish had been saying. Instead, he is more interested in getting getting to lunch, I think. I don't know.
True.
But we knew this was going to happen. He's doing exactly what he said he was going to do.
I wish that the... So, you know, and it goes back forth, right? Democrat, Republican, et cetera. So if the Republican is doing there a line of questioning that maybe Mr. Mueller or the Democrats don't like, then they then turn the time over to the next person. Why doesn't the next congressman say, Mr. Mueller, I will yield my time to let you speak to the previous questions that you didn't get a chance to? Because you get all of this... stuff, and the Republicans can do it the same. When they cakewalk Mueller through an easy set of questions that are affirming what a great guy he is, they could... Actually, the Republicans don't have the same sort of lever there, do they? But certainly the Democrats do. I wish they would. I wish they'd say, wait, answer that thing or say what you wanted to say. But they don't do that. Hey, Steve, ask me something for which I might answer in the affirmative. Could be anything. Do I like ice cream?
Hey, John, are you a baseball fan?
True. That's a good one, too. Do you just kind of look away? True. Ask me another one.
Hey, John, are you enjoying today's hearings?
Oh, now that's not fair. That's not fair.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I wanted questions in which I could answer in the affirmative. True. All right, it's 1:22. A friend of mine is a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's written books about the Constitution, and I think he has a couple of things that you might find interesting to say about what we are hearing today. He's joining us next on WGN. A friend of ours is Dave Schultz. He's a constitutional law professor at the University of Minnesota. He's written books about constitutional law, including Constitutional Law in Contemporary America. He talks about states that matter in presidential elections, and I asked him as he's been watching the testimony today to give us his thoughts on kind of from a procedural standpoint or a constitutional standpoint what he thought. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. I know we're both busy, and I don't have a lot of time today. We've got the news coming up. I'll connect with
right.
you later in the week. But what are some of your reactions, Dave?
Well, I think the first thing that people have to remember is when Mueller did this investigation, three tasks. Was there Russian interference in U.S. elections? Did the Trump campaign aid and abet him? And three, did the Trump administration try to obstruct justice in terms of the Mueller investigation? And this morning we heard really about the obstruction of justice. What guided Mueller's entire inquiry, whether we like it or not, is the fact that the Justice Department concluded back in the 1970s during Watergate, a sitting president of the United States cannot be indicted for a crime. And if both sides were to understand that basic point, whether we agree with it or not, that explains a lot of the conclusions that Mueller came to in terms of saying that, yes, I have all these incidents, these 11 situations where it looked like Trump did things. But if you notice, the Democrats kept trying to push him to say, well, and this is obstruction of justice. And Mueller kept pushing back, saying, I can't reach that conclusion based upon a Justice Department memo. And the Republicans kept saying, well, you've exonerated. No, you didn't say that. So that's the most important thing that I want people to understand, is he was operating under that legal constraint.
They did ask, though, after he's president, could he be convicted? And he said yes, but I didn't know... if they meant that, or if in fact Mueller, because this is something Bill Clinton or Donald Trump would do, that could be in the abstract. When they say, could he be indicted, or would a president under these circumstances be indicted and criminally charged, maybe even convicted? And the answer from Mueller was yes, but I don't know that he meant specifically Donald Trump. It wasn't clear to me.
Exactly. That's, I think you answered it appropriately, is that yes, a president who commits what is arguably criminal acts as president can't be indicted while president, but when he's no longer president, she's no longer president, could be. And he parsed his words very, very carefully here. Now, you could walk away with it saying, okay, since he concluded that the president is not exonerated in obstruction of justice, could somebody potentially bring charges against the president, Donald Trump, after he's president? Yes. But remember, just because you bring charges doesn't mean somebody is guilty. I still think in this country there's this concept called what? Government bears the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's a lot going on here that we have to be thinking about in terms of how Mueller is again, parsing his words very, very carefully.
Dave Schultz, at the beginning of this, you said there's three things that they could have been looking into. One was there interference? Number two, was there assistance? That's the collusion part. And finally, did the president obstruct justice? There's no doubt that there was interference by the Russians and that it was probably Putin who orchestrated it, or at least oversaw it. And then you have the collusion thing, which my view has always been that they tried, they just weren't any good at it. But the obstruction thing is really what we're all focusing on today, and it's almost a moot point going in, right? Mueller is resolute, even though he must have an opinion about this. He refuses to give it, but he's resolute about the fact that since that's not the law, but the policy, that therefore he's not even going to speak to whether or not the president obstructed. All true?
All true, exactly. And the one thing I think you also are true about is how we're focused on the obstruction. When I'm going to speak as an American citizen, what I'm most concerned about is the first one, Russian interference with the U.S. elections. I don't know about you, but to me, that is the most worrisome thing. Not only what the Russians tried to do in 16, but they're probably trying to do now for the 2020 election. So I'll turn it to you. True?
See, that's how you play that game, Steve Bertrand. If you ask something that is going to be answered in the affirmative, you just look away and go, true. Dave Schultz's book.
If I'm serious, I think that's that was the most worrisome part for me.
Yeah, pardon me, I laughed at your quip, but I take your point. Constitutional Law in Contemporary America is one of the books you've written. Previous to that, we spent time talking about The States That Matter. Was that the title of the book that you wrote, Dave?
It was called Presidential Swing States, subtitle, The States That Matter, and it's going to happen all over again in 2020. It'll come down to about 12 states that truly matter.
Dave Schultz is a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. Send your children there so they can take his classes. Dave, I will talk to you again another day.
No problem. Talk to you soon, John. Bye.
David Schultz, law professor. It's 1:31. It's time for WGN Radio News.
Life is short and sweet, concise like a haiku.
What a nice piece you wrote. Without great shows and dining, Chicago's casino could be dealt a losing hand. Can you imagine the hell Lori Lightfoot would have to put up with if this quote-unquote cash cow were given to the rich neighborhoods?
I think you've got to work out a deal that says the location and the economic developments are not the same thing. The location needs to be here, but that some of the benefits need to flow here. And that way you avoid some of the, you know, the issues that I've been talking about.
Says you. You know, the... says, yeah, write that down. Send it to the mayor. It'll go fine. Says Chris Jones, theater critic, Chicago Tribune, joining us yesterday, talking about how to do a casino when it comes to Chicago. You get the feeling the city of Chicago is poised to do it wrong.
Scream and you shout, let it out, and we'll be making it what we want it to be.
Speaking of critics from the Chicago Tribune, Phil Vitale, the restaurant critic over there, joins us Wednesdays at this time. Hi, Phil Vitale.
Hi, John.
By the way, I just want to read a couple of quick texts and tweets. We are following the Mueller report on Capitol Hill. 815 said, Bob Mueller sounds like Bob Newhart. 708 said Bob Mueller loaded up his committee with Hillary contributors. 224 said John Mueller is being rapid-fired questions on a report that stretched 2 years over 700 pages without any foresight of what those questions were going to be. These clowns are grilling him and just auditioning to be future Fox News contributors. And finally, 219 said, the average American doesn't care about the report. It's time to move on. I don't know what that means. I think the average American does care about free elections. That's what the fair elections, free and fair elections. And that's what the report is about. If you don't like the politics, I understand that. But the content you care about, even if you didn't read it. And by the way, you didn't. 3% of us did. It's a TV show now, and it's going mixed. We'll listen in and out of it a little later on as it continues to unfold this afternoon. Do you have anything to say, sir?
On advice of counsel, no.
No, that's not what you say. We have two Mueller responses that you can use. Here's one.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Oh, I like that one.
Or if you don't want to answer a question, just do this.
I'm not going to speak to that.
Ooh. Very handy responses.
Have the second one ready. Ask me if I've ever robbed a bank.
Have you ever robbed a bank?
I'm not going to speak to that.
That's not a denial, sir.
I'm not going to speak to that.
There you are. Let's talk a little bit about the restaurant scene, and then we'll go back to some other stuff on the show today, including Melissa Sanchez from ProPublica, who's going to talk about a topic near and dear to my heart, Lauren Lapkus, too, and maybe yours, and that is that if you don't have a vehicle sticker in Chicago, it's a $200 fine, which is, what's the word? It's too much. It's punishing.
Extortionate.
It's usury. It's extortionate. And then, since you don't have a vehicle sticker, whenever you park, you get a $75 ticket. Even if you have, in fact, got your sticker and you forgot to put it on, you didn't get it on in time and they got you before you did, shame on you, right? But there ought to be grace periods. There ought to be payment plans. Mm-hmm. The city needs to stop punishing people who make mistakes in order to balance its budget. And that's what they do. We'll talk about that after, too. Although I can't imagine we need to say more than that.
No fair.
Hey, listen, there is an article you did not write. Let's just start here and plow through a couple of these quick in the Chicago Tribune. You write about the food scene. You've got a nice restaurant review of some Japanese places that I think you'll enjoy hearing about. But there was also an article that said, here are 10 places to find a great meal along the overpriced dining wasteland of Chicago's Mag Mile. Is the Mag Mile a dining wasteland?
Well, if we found 10 good ones, I would argue maybe not.
Yeah, no
and
kidding.
I can think of 10 other ones that we didn't mention in there. Wasteland, to me, might be...
Well, you didn't write this article. You don't have to agree with everything somebody else writes.
Mm-hmm.
But I do get frustrated sometimes. If you walk from Water Tower Place to the museum, to the Art Institute, say, you're going to see a lot of shops. You're going to see some Starbucks. There are no inviting storefront restaurants, cafes, bistros, burger joints, not even high-end restaurants unless you know where to go.
Right.
I don't think Michigan Avenue is not a dining, is not easy to dine on. Let's put it that
way. It's very hard to walk into a restaurant from the sidewalk and be there. So many places are upstairs, mostly because the landlords would prefer to lease space to retail operations by 2-3 floors at a time and get people in that way. And so the restaurants get kind of shunted aside into maybe the less desirable parcels of real estate.
And then if you were looking for just, you know, a good sandwich and a salad on Michigan Avenue,
mm-hmm.
you want to spend $12.
Oops.
What? Is that an unreasonable request in the
city? I'd say your first half $250 is a bus fare.
Come on, help me out here, Phil.
It's very difficult to dine
$15
inexpensively along Michigan Avenue. I will say that Bandera, a restaurant dear to both of our hearts.
I love that place.
Even if it is, again, up a flight because it didn't get, level.
You got to find it.
That's a very good and economical place to stop in.
Economical, yeah. But okay, so if you do go to Bandera's, you can get a really delicious French dip sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a macho salad, which is a meal unto itself, and it's really good. Both of those are $15.
Right.
And then if you're going to have a beer or a soda, you're in and out for $25, $23.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. And that's sit-down white tablecloth service, too, unless you're sitting at the bar. I'm looking for something a little and I don't want a TGI Fridays. Wouldn't it be nice if there was something in between?
Right. Yeah, it's the not so magnificent mile is where you want to go. Actually, once you get south of the river, you see a lot of little shops, the little Wow Bows and places like that. You can just stroll right into a Naff Naff, the places that are the kind of food you want. But at the moment, the prices being commanded by that part of real estate will keep those guys out of there.
Okay, but the 10 places on the not-so-magnificent mile include the Albert, Beacon Tavern, which is where the Sun Times used to be. Beacon Tavern is over by, there was a McDonald's over there, and it's kind of on the river. Just think not too far from Trump Tower, behind the Wrigley Building. That's a nice place.
It's a beautiful place.
And that's a salad and a sandwich and a beer. That's not bad.
Right.
Not right on Michigan Avenue, but a good choice.
You can also do a much more involved evening meal if you really want to. They do a really good job.
If you want to eat inside Eataly, I don't know that you do, but you can, and they put that on the list.
And, you know, the prime rib sandwich that they have at Eataly, if it's still there, was life-changing when I had
really
it the first
good.
Time. Really, really good. It's not... Except for maybe one spot, it's not formal sit-down dining. It's kind of like you got your pizza station over here, but you do get to sit down. And that's very, very reasonable.
You know where they have a place you can walk into? It's a half a block off of Michigan Avenue. It's Lowry's. They do have a pub pub there.
Exactly.
It's a bistro. And
Carved sandwiches.
Carved sandwiches.
Yeah,
Indian Garden is on the list in the Tribune.
Yeah. That's, again, you're going east of Michigan Avenue by a couple, three blocks.
Another place you'd walk by is La Briola, which is near Bandera. And you're going north on Michigan Avenue from the river. You're past the Tribune Tower. To your right, you'll see a little gateway. Go through there, and there's a restaurant off the block there.
Yes.
Italian. Not bad.
Very good. And Rich Labriola is one of the most best unsung baker in the city of Chicago. He makes great breads and pizza crusts, and he actually supplies a lot of restaurants that don't make a big deal of announcing
kidding,
it.
Really.
Yeah, he does a lot.
The Purple Pig is on their list, and that's... again, just north of the river on the left-hand side, it's called the Purple Pig. I've only been there once or twice and have never understood the attraction. You really like that place.
Yeah. When you went in, you were in the original location.
Yep.
Very small, very cramped.
Tight.
You're sitting on top of everybody.
Yes.
My favorite story I like to tell people, I was having dinner at Purple Pig, sitting across from my companion, and people on either side of us hemmed in because we're at this communal table, and it's one of those things where you have to reach for your napkin and you just kind of put your hand down by where your napkin's supposed to be and do it that way. I had a little something on my fingers. And I did say, wow, they really invested in some very nice napkins here. And then I realized I was touching my hands to the very expensive cashmere scarf on the belonging to the woman next to me. So wherever you are, I am really, really sorry that I didn't stand up for that. But if you found sauce on your scarf, it wasn't you, it was me.
To which Mrs. Vitale said to her husband, the restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune, I can't take you anywhere.
Exactly. Now they've moved into a new place. They've gone a couple of doors south. They have lots more room, a big kind of cool chef counter where you can sit at the counter and watch the chefs do their work.
The food's good.
Yeah, and it's always good. And Jimmy Vannis Jr. runs the place. He was given the Rising Star Chef of the Year award by the James Beard Foundation about 5 years ago.
I will try Purple Pig again. One other just to comment on, then I want to move on to your latest review. Spiaggia and Cafe Spiaggia.
Yeah. One kitchen, two restaurants. So you'll save an awful lot of money at Cafe Spiaggia. And some other places that are there that weren't mentioned besides Bandera, they didn't get to Billy Goat. You can still go down to Billy Goat.
Go downstairs.
And
by the way, of all of the places we've talked, Billy Goat is the least glamorous. I mean, it's a tourist stop.
Means.
But it's just hamburgers and potato chips. It's kind of a dirty bar.
But if you ask for the secret Obama burger, it's a nice burger. You have to ask for it.
Really? I didn't know about that. What is that, a cheeseburger?
It's a cheeseburger, and they put a fried egg on top of it.
Nice.
And what happened is in 2016, he had a campaign headquarters not far from here, and late night they would just go down there, and so many of his volunteers were eating there, they came up with hey, could you make us this kind of burger? And he did, and that became the secret Obama burger.
So it's on the menu without it being on the menu.
That's right. You have to know.
In the Tribune, 10 places to find a great meal along the overpriced dining wasteland of Chicago's Mag Mile. Phil Vitale did not write that. He did write a review, though, of Kumiko and Kiko.
Yes.
Not too far from here.
No, it's out on Lake Street before you get to Halsted Street. It's kind of, you shoot by it the first time, you'll miss it. It's really hard to find, but it's a very good upstairs and downstairs concept. Downstairs is a 10-seat omakase bar that serves a very involved multi-course Japanese menu. The chef's in front of you cooking. The bartenders are right next to it making stuff. It's a really immersive experience, but it is $130, so it's kind of expensive. Upstairs, the main dining room, that's where they have essentially a whole room dedicated to bar snacks, of which there are about a dozen, and no more. None of them is higher than $13.
And they start at 3.
Yeah. Just for a little bite here, and they make
these
really good cocktails. The creative director is Julia Momose, and she's Japan-born and really into sakes and Japanese spirits. And
so is this Kiko or Kumiko?
Well, her cocktail's on both ends, but upstairs is Kumiko. And if you go at the bar, there's a very good chance that Julia is right there at the bar and making cocktails for you, and you're eating. She said it's like the world's greatest cocktail party with these unbelievably good appetizers and world-class cocktails. And that's pretty much exactly what's going on there.
You're right. The 12-course menu that you just referred to is $130. But if you want to do the $3 to $13 with the cocktails and go to that cocktail party, Wednesday through Sundays at 630 West Lake, and you give it 3 conversation-friendly stars.
Yeah, the chef, Maria Russell, is a name to watch. She's really talented.
You are the champion of the Food Bowl.
I am.
I want to talk about that after this. Phil Vitale is the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. What's the Food Bowl, Phil Vitale?
The Food Bowl is our second annual. I can say annual now because we're going to have another one. It takes place in the last 2 weeks or change in August, and it begins on the 14th with a little party and kind of places you can go eat around what we're having at City Hall, not the City Hall, but the restaurant City Hall that's out on West Kinzie. And there, it's just a series of events, all individually priced, and you can participate. Some of them are just free for, you know, you can just go in, and some places you pay for specialty dinners. We have we're having several events up and down the Riverwalk that'll be kind of fun.
I like to think of it as a more interactive restaurant week. It's not just restaurants serving food, but there's themes, there are interactivities.
Yes,
kids, there's a kids in the kitchen thing going on.
You should do my marketing. That was much better than what I started out saying.
I think what you're doing is really good, and I know it's your baby. There's brunch and lunch. A restaurant can but this is your appeal to get restaurants to participate as well as to
right.
tell people to go in August.
Right. In fact, one of the things we didn't do is structure it unduly. We went to the restaurant community and said, what kind of fun events would work for you? And so for the second year, we're going to have a boat trip where you get on the boat at the Riverwalk, just west of here, and ride down the river, and then you get off at Bridgeport and walk a little bit, and then you're at the Duck Inn
nice.
In Bridgeport. And so you have food in the way, and then you have a little meal there, and on the way back, they're going to have drinks and cognacs, and my understanding is perhaps a cigar or three, if that sort of thing appeals to you.
Delicious sandwiches at the Duck Inn, among other things.
Mm-hmm. Anything with the word duck in it, you know, and they do really good. They do great stuff, and so that's just one of the events. Diana Davila, the very well known chef, is for the second year doing her Comida de mi Abuela, the food of my grandmother, with 3 other chefs, and they're going to talk about how family and generations inform their cooking, and then there's food at the end of it.
There's pop-ups and parties. There's a test kitchen event which you can attend. There's panels and talks, kids in the kitchen. There's exclusive dinners and dishes. There's the riverboat trip that he talked about. There's a cocktail thing. There's brunches and lunches. They're looking for you to go, but also you to participate if you're one of the people that provides those things. What's the website people go to kind of get involved?
It's easy. Foodbowlchicago.com.
It's a food bowl. It's in Chicago. They were able to secure foodbowlchicago.com as a website.
Yeah. And it will be fun. And some of these events, maybe a lot of these events, are going to sell out. So take a look. You can get on that site and see all of them and see which ones appeal and get involved or
always,
have fun.
Always a pleasure to read you. Always a
Thank
pleasure
you.
To talk to you. Thank Phil. Thank you, Phil.
My pleasure.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Every day.
Here's John Williams.
Living. This is John in the Allstate Skyline Studio till 3. I appreciate you tuning in. Remember, on Facebook, it's WGN King John is me. We post a daily web poll question, too. It's called the News Click. We ask you about something in the news. Here's yesterday's click. The state minimum wage goes to $15 an hour in 2025. You got to wait till 2025 for the state mandated minimum wage to be $15. But that's progress. Many Chicago aldermen want $15 an hour to come sooner by 2021. You had three options, $15 an hour in 2025. What the state wants is right, and a third of you said that. 47% of you said $15 an hour sooner in 2021 is right. And a fourth of you, not sure I'm getting all these percentages right, 23% of you said $15 an hour in 2021 is still not enough. 2021 comes around, and somebody can pay you as little as $15 an hour. That's just not getting it done. I yesterday asked you to tell me your stories. Text me how little you're working for, how much you're working for, just what's it like out there. And never mind if you're a waiter or waitress, although that matters too, but these are the minimum wages of people that work in stores and shops and factories and radio stations, whatever. And it was amazing. I actually don't have them in front of me, but a lot of you responded. And a lot of you are or know someone who's making $10 an hour, $9 an hour. Literally, one guy, it might have been a guy, he sounds like he worked in a tire shop. And it was a manufacturing, so I'm not sure, I don't think they were making tires, but it was something in that sector. And he said, guys are here working for $7 an hour. He says, I can't believe they get people to do it. I think I know why some people might do that, but it's amazing what is going on out there. My number is 312-981-7200. We'll continue to listen in on the Mueller testimony.
To analyze the credibility of countless witnesses, but you weren't able to do so with this witness.
Well, with every witness, particularly a leading witness, one assesses the credibility day by day, witness by witness, document by document. And that's what happened in this case.
Val Demings is a Democrat from Florida.
By the end, we ended up with a fair amount. Fair amount.
Thank you. Well, let's go through some of the answers to take a closer look at his credibility, because it seems to me directly.
You can tell right away who's who on these things, because that's just a lady talking. So that's a Democrat. And actually, that's the most he's responded to anything, which didn't seem to be that substantive. And then the Republicans are a little angrier. It's funny, because if the Mueller report completely exonerated President Trump, I'm not sure what they're so fussy about. I was literally a little surprised when things got going today. I mean, I knew they'd be maybe on the attack, but I didn't think they needed to attack that much, since by their own account, they won.
Right. So they had to, it was a conflict, because on the one hand, they said the president was exonerated, but on the other hand, they said the investigation was flawed. So they were like, you know, pushing against each other.
Ask me something I can respond in the affirmative to.
Is summer one of your favorite four seasons?
True.
Mike Quigley, the Chicago congressman, did get a bit of a headline this afternoon when he was talking to Mueller about WikiLeaks, and the president praising WikiLeaks during the campaign. And Mueller said to say that was problematic is an understatement.
Here's what I have to say about that.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
That's my response. Let's change topics. We asked her to join us again, and she's always good when she comes on. Melissa Sanchez from ProPublica joins us on WGN Radio to talk about a topic. I think this is the third time we've talked about. Melissa, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Hey, very good. Thanks for having me on again.
See, now that's already a more substantive answer than we've heard all day from Washington, D.C.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you for inviting me to come on. That would be a book, according to Robert Mueller today. And I didn't ask you to comment on that. So last time you were with us, you spoke about how the city issues tickets for people who have not. Hold on, I got to turn something off because I don't want to hear it. There it is. People who issue the city issues tickets to people who don't have vehicle stickers. Vehicles get towed, stuff like that. Right? That's what you've been reporting on.
Yep.
What are some of the big takeaways from your ongoing reporting on this, Melissa?
I mean, like, big picture, tens of thousands of mostly very low-income and black drivers have been filing for bankruptcy over the past few years because of this massive ticket debt. And so that's what I spent a good chunk of last year reporting on. And yesterday, we got the first really major reforms to the system. Mayor Lightfoot announced a number of huge changes that I think are going to really transform the lives of tens of thousands of people.
In what way?
So the first one is that the city's going to stop suspending driver's licenses over unpaid parking tickets. And in addition to just doing that on its own, the city is going to support legislation that's been stalled in Springfield for several years that would essentially do the same thing. And if this becomes a law, which with the mayor's support, Chicago's mayor is very powerful, and in the past, Rahm never supported this. But now with the mayor's support, if this becomes law, that has the potential to help some 55,000 people immediately get their driver's licenses back. So that's huge. I mean, without a driver's license, it's really difficult for folks to get to work, to get their kids to school. A lot of people drive illegally with suspended licenses, and then they risk entering the criminal justice system because of that if they get pulled over.
Or they get their car towed, they lose their car. They lose the ability to make money, to pay the fines the city wants them to pay. The city's policy has been dumb about this, just from a monetary standpoint. If somebody, especially, and as you said in your reporting, 8 out of the 10 top zip codes for which these tickets are written are in the poorest communities in Chicago. If you want those people to pay the fines, don't take away their ability to earn money.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what I've been saying all along. I wish I could say this is dumb in my articles, but it's really hard to understand the logic. I mean, it's a really punitive thing, and they want to punish folks, and that might the threat of getting their license suspended, it might trigger folks like you and me to pay up because we can afford to. But people who don't have the ability to pay are really stuck. So the license suspension thing to me is the biggest thing. And the second one that's really substantial is reforming the city's payment plans. This might sound kind of wonky, bureaucratic, but the way it's set up right now, if you owe the city a lot of money for unpaid tickets, and I talk to people who owe $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 in unpaid tickets, if you owe the city a significant amount of money, they require you to put down a down payment of $1,000 just to get on a payment plan. And you want to get on a payment plan because if you're on a payment plan, you can get the license back, you can get the car back. But $1,000 is really, really, really difficult for poor people to afford. And so what Lightfoot's proposing that's likely to become a new city policy is to reduce those payment plan requirements from $1,000 down to $100 or less down. And that's going to be life-changing because what's happening right now is the city's payment plans are just unaffordable for a large portion of the people who live in the city, and as a result, they file for bankruptcy. And why do they file for bankruptcy? Because you can file for bankruptcy for free, and you get the same results. You get your license back, et cetera. So I think those two things together are really going to improve the situation for a lot of families.
As a result of this, Melissa, wasn't it your reporting that Chicago leads the nation in bankruptcy filings?
It does. It's something that we should all be very proud of. Just kidding.
Just kidding. Now, the mayor, Mayor Emanuel's take on this, you said it's, you know, I don't mean to mischaracterize what you said, but if you intimated that it's hard to understand the city's logic on this, the former mayor's logic was, if you can't pay the fine, don't do the crime. He said, if you break the law, you need to pay for it. It's just clear and simple.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not like he started all of this. It started way before he did. Harold Washington was actually the first mayor who asked the state to change the law to allow the license suspension. I mean, this has been going on for decades. So I don't want to throw just Mayor Emanuel under the bus. But I think there was this narrative that has existed for decades in the city that people are deliberately scoffing the law, that they have the money and they're just not doing it because they don't want to, and so we should go after them. And I think that narrative has been changed over the past year and
well,
a half.
If I may, it could be both. I mean, I think some people don't have the money, some people do have the money, but a lot of people on both sides of that will delay or not pay money if they don't have to. What's a city sticker cost? $150, something like that?
Yeah, something. It depends on the size of the weight of the vehicle, between $89 and about $135.
Okay,
I do think you're right. There's people who don't do it because they have a garage where they can park their car and they don't need to worry about it because nobody's going to go into their private garage and ticket them. But I also think, you know, some people can't afford it, but also some people probably don't even know that it's a rule. They get hit suddenly with stickers.
Yeah.
And then things come up. I mean, like, you're life can get crazy and you might forget to renew it, and then a week or two pass and suddenly you've got like three of these tickets that cost $200 a pop, and with penalties rise to close to $500 each. So it's just really, really easy to screw up and then get in the spiral of debt.
So it's $200 is the fine, and it just, they upped it a year and a half ago, I think, from $120, $200 if you don't have a vehicle sticker or one that's current. And then mm-hmm. if they happen to catch you without a current vehicle sticker and you're parked, then it's a $75 parking fee. So all of a sudden, you're sitting there twiddling your thumbs and you've got a $275 bill. You know, Melissa, maybe you did this. I just clicked around some other cities to see what their comparable fines were. And the few that I was able to find were a lot less than Chicago.
No, that's right. And I mean, and most, like, no large city in this country has such a thing as a city sticker. It's like a very uniquely Chicago and Illinois thing. Other municipalities have city stickers in Illinois, and they're also a lot cheaper. The tickets themselves are a lot cheaper elsewhere. So it's a combination of problems. It's like the punitive going after folks' licenses and crippling their ability to work. It's the high price of the tickets. It's the high price of the penalties. It's the aggressive towing and booting of vehicles, all of these things kind of compounded, plus the cameras. The cameras then were just like one more layer of trouble.
The red light cameras.
Yep.
So Mayor Lightfoot comes in, and maybe on the heels of your reporting, it was also published in Mother Jones, etc. She says, okay, let's take a more sensible approach to this. Was Mayor Lightfoot going to do that either way, or was it because of what you all said?
I mean, I think that the reporting that we did, along with BZ and some other folks, is what's changed the whole narrative here. There were some advocacy groups that were beginning to look at the issue. There was one that was looking at the license suspension issue in Springfield. But I think, not to brag, but I mean, this reporting really changed the way people saw this issue.
Well,
and
it changed the way who saw this issue, because the City Hall knew what the hell they were doing. They make $264 million a year. And this is a city that doesn't even get parking meter money. They make $250 million a year on this alone. I mean, that's stunning to me.
It's stunning. And then the number that makes me kind of lose it is there's billions of dollars in supposed ticket debt. I mean, the city does bring in those couple $100 million a year, but left on the table is hundreds of millions of dollars more each year that people don't pay because they can't afford it. And it's sort of like funny money that's out there. I think the city was just looking at the money that was coming in, looking for ways to bring in more money. But there's been other cities, very few, and the examples are always like the liberal cities on the West Coast. But I think San Francisco has made really significant changes to how they ticket and what they charge people for payment plans. And as a result of doing that, people who can afford to pay a smaller monthly amount pay it, and the city's actually bringing in more revenue. And I'm not saying it's apples to apples. I don't know if the same thing's going to happen here in Chicago. But if folks can afford to pay a down payment or make the monthly payments, if they have the money, they'll do it. But if you say $1,000 down, otherwise, like, go file for bankruptcy, people are going to go file for bankruptcy.
You know, my colleague here, Lauren Lapka, just came to Chicago, back to Chicago from Oregon, where they allow you to pay for 2 years. So the one-year deadline came and went before she fully grasped that. And they have a more lenient warning system where if they catch you, they give you time to pay it, and they make you a peanut butter sandwich. And I like the grace period. If you said to a lot of people listening right now, hey, your deadline came and went, you've got 7 days to get to City Hall or to the post office. I think a lot of people would. And if not, then it's on them. But what's the harm in that, right?
Yeah, and actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because they are preparing to do not quite an amnesty. I think they're afraid to use that word, but sometime this fall, they're figuring out how to do a program where if you go in and you buy your city sticker, if you buy your sticker, then if you come into compliance, then they'll forgive either some or all of your outstanding city sticker tickets. I think that would be really great, because there's something like $500 million, like billion with a B, numbers that I can't even fathom, $500 million in outstanding debt for city sticker tickets alone.
That's
so much money.
In one city. This isn't in the United States or, say, the Western Hemisphere. This is in Chicago. It's crazy. Okay, hold on 1 second. Melissa writes for ProPublica, Melissa Sanchez. So one last thing, Melissa, if I may, just bear with me. I'm going to play a couple commercials, come back. So what is the new plan then? Describe for me how easier, softer, / better we are in Chicago. Stand by. Listening to the testimony in queue. We're back now. Catch Living Healthy Chicago this Saturday at 9. Learn about the struggles and successes of everyday Chicagoans with health and fitness. Living Healthy Saturday at 9 a.m. on WGN-TV. Raja Krishnamurthy, the suburban congressman from the Chicago area, comes on this show now and again. I wish more of the Republican congressmen would in this state. We only have Democrat senators, and most of the Chicago and suburban constituency are Democrats as well. But there are some downstate and central Illinois Republican lawmakers. They are loath to come on these shows sometimes. And honestly, I don't know why, because I think we're fair and we have a lot of conservative listeners. But that notwithstanding, Raja did, he's on this intelligence committee. He just got a chance to question Mueller. Raja got everybody to laugh. I'll play for you what happened after the 2:30 edition of WGN Radio News. I just want to close with Melissa Sanchez. In the meantime, the ProPublica reporter whose reporting really has helped move the needle. So the mayor and others in City Hall have said, okay, we should do something about these fines for parking stickers that aren't, that are due and you haven't renewed it. And now you've got a ticket. Now you've got a parking ticket. It's a cash cow for the city. So just can you give me the highlights then, Melissa? What is Lori going to do that will make it different?
I mean, the big things, like I said, so if City Hall approves this, the City Council approves this come September, so the city will stop suspending licenses over parking tickets. They're going to lobby for state legislation to make this a state law. They're going to change the payment plan so they're more affordable at the onset for folks and give people more time to pay so they have smaller monthly payments. And they're going to make a lot of changes to the city sticker tickets, which, as we talked about before, are just really expensive. And one thing I think your listeners might appreciate, too, is that they will reinstate that 15-day grace period after your sticker ticket expires. So if it expires on Monday, you don't get ticketed on Tuesday. You'll have 2 weeks, more or less, to go buy your ticket, your sticker, before you get ticketed again. And there's going to be some minor form of amnesty that they're still working out for the city sticker ticket debt if you come into compliance and buy a sticker.
Be an interesting sort of civics experiment here, right? Will this increase revenue or will this decrease revenue?
Yeah, and the mayor says that they expect it to be cost neutral because so many more people will be able to get into compliance, and there was so much money that they weren't collecting anyway. So we'll see. We'll see. Hopefully it is cost neutral, and then this will inspire more cities to do the same kind of thing.
I like to say, if you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper or log on to ProPublica, the Illinois version.com. What's the website where your stuff is posted, Melissa?
ProPublica.org/Illinois.
ProPublica.org/Illinois. Write him a check, too, for this kind of reporting. Nice to talk to you, Melissa.
Hey, thank you for having me. Have a good one.
Melissa Sanchez at ProPublica.
One day more, another day, another destiny. This never-ending road to Calvary. These men who seem to know my crime will surely come a second time, one day more.
I did not live until today.
Ashley, what are you doing?
How can I live when we are parted?
So,
What we are listening to right now is One Day More, and it's a song from Les Mis. And the reason I'm playing this song is because Les Mis is currently at the Cadillac Palace Theater. It's at 151 West Randolph Street in Chicago. And it's here till July 27th, so go see it before it leaves. And the shows range from matinees at 2 p.m. to later evening shows at 7:30 or at 8 p.m. So it should be a fun little night on the town.
Is this your show?
No. I do love this show. Yeah. I am a big theater fan, and this show is amazing because it's all sung, and it really is a classic, so definitely highly recommend it.
What's your show? You get to go to one show.
Have you ever seen Something Rotten?
No.
That is hysterical. It is a new musical, and I highly recommend it.
Something Rotten.
Was that the Steve Martin, Michael Caine film?
I don't
know. No, that was Rotten Scoundrels.
Yeah, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
How about you, Steve? You got a play? You got a musical? You're going to go to one musical. What's it going to be?
Wow. I don't have one. Billy Elliot.
Nice. Billy Elliot. Yeah, yeah.
See, Les Mis is my show, but I also like to see new shows. But Les Mis has been my favorite, and I've seen maybe a dozen.
Who's seen Hamilton? I've seen it.
Hamilton. I saw that.
Yeah. Brenda.
One I haven't seen.
A friend of ours was in from out of town. Brenda and I had seen it, and then Brenda went a second time with her girlfriend and loved it so much more the second time. Brenda and I came out of there. I'll just speak for myself, and
I remember this.
I said to Chris Jones, he wanted to throw me out the window. I go, it's really good. It's a fine show. It's a really good show. It's a great show, whatever. But it wasn't the show I thought I was going to get.
Yep, I remember that conversation. I think you did it on a Saturday, didn't you?
Yes, in fact,
yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
You didn't call in and support me on that.
No, I had to repair the light I drove into.
I think the show that I like the most is often the one I've seen most recently. Like when Wicked came out, I had so much fun at Wicked. I saw that a couple of times. How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. If I went to a show tomorrow, I might pick that one. I love that show. And then the big, great ones, of course, are there. Book of Mormon. The first time I saw, I was offended. First time I saw Book of Mormon, I thought, seriously? Really? I couldn't believe it.
But didn't you know that's how it was supposed to be when you went to see it?
I should have known.
I saw people walk out, and I've heard that happens a lot. But again, if you don't know the show going into it, of course you're going to be offended.
Well, because the people that do it were the same people that did South Park, right? And so you go, okay, guys, you know what South Park's like. Imagine it on stage and the gloves are off. But there were just literally some lines in the songs in Book of Mormon that just made my jaw drop. And people were laughing hysterically. And my thought about that was that they were laughing because they were shocked by what they'd heard. Now, granted, some of those lines were also funny. And what they were saying, they had a point of view. But I think some of it was just shock as much as it was humor. And I wasn't laughing with them at times because...
Right, so you were offended at Book of Mormon, and you didn't really like... You don't like musical theater, do you?
I really do.
It's a weird question for you to ask, then, what we like, because...
It's funny, because when Rent came out the first time, I was a Rent head. I saw Rent, like, four times. We went to New York to see Rent. I spent money on Rent. But, fair enough, Les Mis in Chicago. Go see that show, too. It's 2:41. Raja Krishnamurthy had a chance to ask Bob Mueller some questions. This is how our local congressman on the Intel Committee started his query of the former special prosecutor.
Director Mueller, thank you for your devoted service to your country. Earlier today, you described your report as detailing a criminal investigation, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Director, since it was outside the purview of your investigation, your report did not reach counterintelligence conclusions regarding the subject matter of your report.
That's true.
For instance, since it was outside your purview, your report did not reach counterintelligence conclusions regarding any Trump administration officials who might potentially be vulnerable to compromise or blackmail by Russia, correct?
those decisions probably were made in the counter in the FBI.
But not in your report, correct?
Not in our report. We advert to counterintelligence goals of our investigation, which were secondary to any criminal wrongdoing that we could find.
Two things about that. Mueller's ability to speak is shockingly bad. You just hadn't heard him talk much, and certainly not contemporaneously, where he's answering questions on the fly. But his powers of recall, granted a 700-page report, 2 years of work, but it's what he's done 24 hours a day. And you think he would have studied. Of course he studied. He has his name on the report. Nobody knows it better than him. He just doesn't speak fluidly. It's very surprising and very disappointing. Of course, Raja says, thanks for your dedicated service. That's the way the Democrats started. The Republicans are a little more businesslike because they're not sallying up to him, right? But I think what Raj is doing here is also the problem for the Democrats, and that is that since Mueller didn't reach the conclusion that some of them want and won't accommodate them, all they're left with is sort of this double negative. But you didn't find that he didn't do this, right? So maybe it's possible that there was. I mean, literally, that's what he's doing. They're saying, well, you didn't say that that didn't happen, right? And the conclusion that you might then draw is that, okay, then they did do these bad things. And in fact, that may be the truth. But the closest you can get to that is Raj asking him if they didn't find something that didn't happen, and therefore maybe it did. I hope you're still with me. We're on WGN. Okay, so here's another sort of Q&A between Raj and Bob Mueller.
Similarly, since it was outside your purview, your report does not address the question of whether Russian oligarchs engaged in money laundering through any of the president's businesses, correct?
Correct.
And of course, your office did not obtain the president's tax returns, which could otherwise show foreign financial sources, correct?
I'm not going to speak to that.
In July 2017... The president said his personal finances were off limits or outside the purview of your investigation, and he drew a quote-unquote red line around his personal finances. Were the president's personal finances outside the purview of your investigation?
I'm not getting into that.
Ding.
Were you instructed by anyone not to investigate the president's personal finances?
No.
Mr. Mueller, I'd like to turn your attention to counterintelligence risks associated with lying. Individuals can be subject to blackmail if they lie about their interactions with foreign countries, correct?
True.
For example, you successfully charged former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn of lying to federal agents about his conversations with Russian officials, correct?
Correct.
Since it was outside the purview of your investigation, your report did not address how Flynn's false statements could pose a national security risk because the Russians knew the falsity of those statements, right?
I cannot get into that mainly because there are many elements of the FBI that are looking at different aspects of that issue.
Currently?
Currently.
Thank you. As you noted in Volume 2 of your report, Donald Trump repeated 5 times in one press conference, Mr. Mueller, in 2016, quote, I have nothing to do with Russia. Of course, Michael Cohen said Donald Trump was not being truthful because at this time Trump was attempting to build Trump Tower Moscow. Your report does not address whether Donald Trump was compromised in any way because of any potential false statements that he made about Trump Tower Moscow, correct?
I think that's right.
Director Mueller, I want to turn your attention to a couple other issues. You've served as FBI director during 3 presidential elections, correct?
Yes.
And during those 3 presidential elections, you have never initiated an investigation at the FBI looking into whether a foreign government interfered in our elections the same way you did in this particular instance, correct?
Well, I would say I personally know, but the FBI quite obviously has an attack such as the Russians undertook in 2016.
Now, Director Mueller, Is there any information you'd like to share with this committee that you have not so far today?
Well, that's a broad question. and it'd take me a while to get an answer to it, but I'll say no.
That's the funny part. That's it. That was the and that's where they kind of everybody smiled and chuckled a little bit, but that's all you get. But that's kind of the way it goes. So the Democrats are asking double negatives, which might be inferred as a positive, but he won't say that. And again, I'm just almost saddened by Mr. Mueller's testimony because I don't think it's been that productive and because I don't think he's coming across that well. Other people see his responses as dignified and reserved and appropriate, and I'll guarantee you all of that. But I also thought he would be a little more, I don't know, dynamic, and he has not been that. So at the end of the day, you're going to get Republicans claiming victory and Democrats claiming victory. The president put out a tweet during this saying, send me $2 million in the next 24 hours. Help us raise our campaign funds. And that's where we started the day. The texts include these. John, the man is 74 years old. Sure he is. I know that. And I know that at 74, you're not as energetic as you were when you were 34. I'm still surprised and disappointed. About shows, John, quirky but excellent musical, Lumberjacks in Love. So good. Never heard of that one. John, I didn't like Titanic the first time I saw it, but now I love that movie. Yeah, I guess that happens. The Band's Visit, which won every Tony last year, is coming here. See it. It's funny. It's touching and beautiful. John, The Band's Visit. We loved it. John, Raja Krishnamurthy sent a record for the most I can't get into that's responses by a Democrat today, not to mention some lame questions that had nothing to do with what was going on. Actually, I don't know who set the record for it, but you know they're talking about that today. I was literally, during the testimony of Bob Mueller, writing down his responses because they're so short and the questions are so long that you actually have time to type verbatim what he said. So I'll just read to you a series of answers that he gave in their entirety in this order. I'm not going to speak to that. Question, 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 question. I can't speak to that. More question. That was outside our purview. True. I'm sorry, what was the question? I'm not going to speak to that. I'm not going to get into that. As I said at the outset, this is one of the investigations that's being handled by others. I'm not going to answer that question, sir. I do not accept your characterization. I'm not going to speak to that. I'm not going to answer that. As I said at the outset this morning, that was one of the investigations I could not speak to. I have nothing to add. Yes and yes.
And the few I do not recall.
And a couple of I recall, do not recall is thrown in for good measure. And this is the thing. Listen, a lot of times when people are saying this, it's because they don't want to perjure themselves or they don't want to admit to some wrongdoing. It's the equivalent of taking the fifth. You will oftentimes not answer the questions or be evasive because it'll be injurious to yourself. That's not Mueller's case. Mueller's case is he's going to toe the line. He's going to play by what he perceives to be the rules. It's not the law, but that there's precedent, and so he's not going to talk about a lot of these things.
I think he's doing everything possible not to play to one side, so neither Republicans or Democrats can claim that he's favoring.
Isn't that interesting? And so I was talking to Phil Vitale, the restaurant critic from the Tribune, when he came into the studio, and he says, I'm listening to your show, and it sounds like both sides are scoring points. I said, yeah, but what happens is instead of each side feeling affirmed, each side is ticked. I think people that are listening to me sort of recap what happened or who are watching the testimony, I'd say Democrats are very frustrated, and I would say Republicans are very frustrated. I would gather, if you were keeping score at home, that at the end of the day, Republicans are going to feel the most victorious. They're going to feel the most exonerated. But I don't know. Addison Russell got sent down to AAA. I didn't see that coming, Kevin. Did you?
Kind of, yeah. He just sort of obviously hasn't looked focused. He's made a lot of mistakes on the base paths, and that's really what Joe Maddon was pointing to.
That base running stuff really bit him in the butt.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, he got Saturday was a nightmare for him. He got thrown out at home, didn't advance on a wild pitch. He just doesn't look like he's completely dialed in right now. John, he gets booed every at-bat at Wrigley.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
Really? Are we booing Addison Russell?
Well, that's why I wanted to ask you, because you seem like you would have a good answer to this. Do you draw the line, like, or are we forever, for the rest of his career, does he get booed?
Well, they weren't booing him when he came back. Remember, he was away because of the what he was happening with him and his wife. But when he came back, they cheered.
No. He got booed heavily.
Definitely booed.
I was at the game.
He got booed the day he came back?
Wrigley was full of boos, yeah.
Wow. So have they been booing him ever since then?
Yeah, I still, every at-bat I hear at least a handful of boos.
Wow.
And a boo at Guaranteed Rate when Cubs were there.
So, okay, but to be clear, they're not booing his poor performance. They're booing the person.
Right, what happened.
And what's your question to the jury?
Does a player, for what he did, does he deserve to get booed the rest of his career? Because it's starting to look that way.
At least in Chicago.
Yeah.
If he was hitting 300, the boo birds would have gone away.
Yeah.
I think so.
I think there would still be a couple out there. But a lot less. You're right.
I'm trying to think of somebody who everybody booed and then he did well and they forgave him.
Aroldis Chapman.
Well, there's that, but he didn't do that here. He was, you know, that's the thing. I think if Addison Russell goes somewhere else,
Fresh start situation.
He'll have a fresh start.
Yeah, he just doesn't look. He looks completely out of it this year. He doesn't look. I mean, it's pretty crazy to think. I mean, back in 2016, think about the numbers he had that year. He had 21 homers, 95 RBIs, huge homers in the postseason. He was the future shortstop of the Cubs, and this is where he's at now.
When Ryan Braun went back to Milwaukee, did they boo him or cheer him?
I think he's booed in Milwaukee or cheered on in Milwaukee. I don't think he gets booed up there.
So it's
he gets booed here. he and Bryce Harper, those two, when they come to town, get booed more than any other player.
Yeah, well, Harper's maybe not likable, but at least Braun cheated, and Russell was criminal. So I'm just trying to think of instances where somebody, they went away and they came back, but if they did well, the fans are like, yeah, but you know, you're doing pretty well.
Right.
And I think that's what fans do. I thought the question was going to be, do you ever boo your own players? And I'm loath to do that because they're my players. I want my team to win. Booing my players, even when they're bad people or perform badly, if you're just looking at it from a fan standpoint, that doesn't help the team. So I've never understood when one of your players is in a slump or if your pitcher gives up a home run and has a bad outing and fans might boo him. I'm like, well, how is that going to help? I've never understood that. Yeah. You may disagree with me
on that. Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, Carl Edwards got booed horribly the other night. After, you know, he hit a batter, walked a batter, gave up
guy.
A hit. He's just having a rough year.
That was a bad. And how long had he been gone, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was his first appearance mid-June, early
He's just
June.
Thinking, oh, man, just get through this inning.
Right.
Just get through this inning.
And it was a disaster.
It was the worst possible outcome.
It was not good.